Since the 1st of April, TNI, in collaboration with allies, has brought together experts and activists to discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how it must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow everyone to live with dignity. The following is a recording of a webinar featuring Sonia Shah, author of Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, which was published in 2017, as well as experts on public health and systems and activists on the front lines responding to the crisis in the Global South. They tackle the question, how can social movements mobilize an internationalist response?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's great to have you on this call. Thank you so much for joining us today for this critical conversation on building an internationalist response to the coronavirus crisis. It's really, we have so far 433 people on this call, and it's amazing to see how many have joined us from every country and continent on the world. And I think it's really truly inspiring because it also shows that there's a very strong desire among so many people to build an internationalist and people-led response to this crisis. So we're really glad that you've joined us, and we hope you'll find this conversation and this webinar an interesting and a fruitful one. Just to introduce myself first, my name is Nick Buxton. I coordinate publications and our Future Labs work at the Transnational Institute. I'm joining myself this webinar from Davis, California, where I live, and I'm going to be joined, co-hosted by Jess Graham, who's based in the Netherlands, who will be trying to make sure that this runs as smoothly as possible. I should warn you that we've never kind of organized a webinar on this scale or scope before, so please bear with us if there are any technical difficulties. We'll try and sort them out as best we can. I don't want to take too much time from the panelists, but I thought it'd be useful just to share a little about what we hope to do in this next 90 minutes with you, and also just what our kind of goal with this whole webinar series was. One of the things that we felt as this crisis unfolded right across the globe was that there was very much a focus on US, well, and obviously initially China, US and Europe. But as a transnational institute, we were very concerned that there was much less focus on the Global South. And perhaps if the pandemic teaches us anything, it's that pathogens know no boundaries, know no borders. So our movements can't need to organize transnationally too. And so we're very much aware that right now the crisis is just starting to unfold in the Global South. And we know how difficult it has been for even the much more resourced health systems in the Global North to cope with this. So we can only imagine what's going to happen as this really takes root throughout the Global South. And just to give one example, I was reading yesterday that the UK is desperately trying to source 30,000 ventilators. It already has 5,000 ventilators, but it needs another 30,000. Well, Mali has just 20 ventilators for the whole country. That's just one ventilator for every million people. So we know that there's going to be a very disproportionate impact of this crisis. And we know that this lack of health infrastructure is not an accident or a freak of nature. It's very much been caused by systemic and structural causes. It's a result of colonialism. It's a result of legacies of debt, of unequal trade exchange, of neoliberal policies, of the decimation of many social services in the Global South. So unless we start to undress these underlying causes of health inequities, we know that we won't be able to tackle this pandemic or even future ones. Now, in 90 minutes, we can only really start to have this conversation, but I hope we can start to at least address these three questions in this webinar. On a global level, who will be most impacted by the pandemic and why? And number two, what are the national and international economic and social structures and systems that led to this pandemic and will shape its disproportionate impact? And three, what should be the international political agenda and priorities for a progressive left to confront both this immediate pandemic, address future pandemics, and ultimately guarantee health and dignity for all. So I'm really excited to answer these questions in some ways that we have an amazing panel of speakers today, right from across the globe, to reflect on these issues. In terms of the structure of the webinar, we will first have the main presentation by our key guest, Sonia Shah. Sonia wrote the book, a very prescient book now, and which is why she's in hot demand, Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, which was published in 2017. So she will do the main presentation. She'll speak for 15 minutes. And then we're going to invite in four panelists from different parts of the globe for two brief rounds of exchanges, and then open up to questions at the end. In terms of your participation, we encourage you to use the chat, both to ask questions of the panelists, to share your feedback, and also to make suggestions and proposals. We hope very much that this will be both an educational webinar, but also a chance for us to share some ideas around strategies as well as we tackle this unprecedented pandemic. So you should be able to see the chat if you move down to the bottom of your screen. If you move the mouse or if you're on your phone, you'll have an option which says chat, and there you can post your things. And we have some TNI staff on the chat who can also answer any questions and point you to any resources.
So the Q&A.
So I'm going to now, and there's also a question and answers tab as well, which where you can post specifically questions for the panelists. We won't have time obviously to answer all of them, but we will choose some of at least three questions at the end. I'd like to pass over now to Fiona Dove. She's the director of Transnational Institute, and she's going to introduce both the Institute briefly and also our co-organizing institutions. And it's great to have you on board. Over to you, Fiona.
Thank you, Nick, and thank you to all the panelists, including some who've had to stay up very late at night to be able to join us this evening, this afternoon, this morning for some. I wanted to introduce the three organizations that are co-hosting today's webinar. Firstly, of course, it's the Transnational Institute, TNI. We're based in Amsterdam. We're an activist research institute. We're internationalists in our orientation, and we work on a broad range of issues. So we're not a one issue organization. And we do research and advocacy to support social movements around the world. So that's TNI. The second organization co-hosting this is the Alternative Information and Development Center. They are based in Cape Town in South Africa, my home country. And AIDC characterizes itself as an activist think tank working across South Africa with trade unions, popular organizations, and scholar activists, very similar to TNI. And our third co-host is Focus on the Global South. Both AIDC and Focus are very long-standing allies of TNI. Focus also describes itself as an activist think tank. It's located in Southeast Asia, but have offices in India and Thailand, and also people in the Philippines, and they work across the Southeast Asian region. Focus, AIDC, and TNI all work on very similar issues of basically encompassing democracy, economic justice, including climate justice, TNI also works on security questions. So these are the three organizations that are co-hosting today. We hope that this will be the first in a number. Nick will tell us at the end a bit more about forthcoming webinars. And I thought it might be nice, given who I anticipate the 500 odd people that you are participating in the seminar, that we all knew Martin Kaur, or at least we knew of Martin Kaur, and Martin died last night. So I thought it would be nice that we remember him and just think about the contributions that Martin could have made. Martin has spoken on many of these issues, including epidemics, in the past, and it feels like we've lost someone who could have contributed so much needed analysis at this terrible time. So just remember Martin. Nick, I think it's back to you.
Yep. Thank you, Fiona. Well, I'm now honoured to introduce Sonia Shah, who will be our main speaker, who's kindly given her time at a very busy time to us at a very busy time for her. Sonia Shah is an investigative science journalist and author of a number of critically acclaimed books. She's done one on the drugs industry, on big oil, and on malaria too. But most importantly for this course, she wrote, as I said earlier, the book, the prize-winning book, Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond, which was published in 2017, in which she explored the underlying causes and dynamics of global pandemics. The book was a finalist for the Los Angeles Book Prize in Science and Technology. And she has both a unique and I think a global and a holistic perspective. So I'm really glad that she's able to join us to share her insights. She's joining us from Baltimore in the US. Welcome, Sonia.
There we go. Hi, everyone. Thank you for having me. And thanks for hosting this this webinar. So as you mentioned in the introduction, my work has been about the intersection between science and politics. And I'm broadly been interested in sort of lopsidedness and inequalities within societies and between societies and sort of how that kind of expresses itself. And that's one reason why I started writing about global health and contagious diseases, because they really travel on those veins of inequality. So with my last book, Pandemic, what I was trying to look at is how does a microbe turn into a pandemic-causing pathogen? We know that, you know, most narratives about contagion kind of start with the epidemic, with everyone dying all at once, and it's this big drama, and then there's this, you know, heroic scientist who tries to figure out what happened. What I wanted to do is to start way before that, so to sort of end with the epidemic and to look at how a microbe actually turns into something that causes so much death and disruption. Because what we do know is that all the microbes that cause pandemics and epidemics, they are not new, they are newly emerged. So over the past 50 to 70 years, we've had over 300 of these new kinds of newly emerged pathogens, either coming out of, you know, into places they've never been seen before, or just, you know, brand new to science altogether. So coronavirus is just the latest in a long line. We've had Ebola in West Africa, where it had never been seen before. We had Zika in the Americas, where it had never been seen before. We've had new kinds of tick-borne illnesses, new kinds of mosquito-borne diseases, new kinds of antibiotic-resistant bacterial pathogens, and, you know, the list goes on and on. And we know that about 60% of these are derived from the bodies of animals. About 70% of these microbes are from the bodies of wild animals. So these are not new. They live in the animals and don't make those animals sick. So Ebola virus is in bats. Coronavirus is in bats. It doesn't make bats sick. But what's happened is we've created pathways for these microbes that live in animals' bodies to come into our bodies. And that is broadly because of human invasion of wildlife habitat. We've taken over half of the surface of the planet with our homes, towns, cities, mines, farms, etc. And what that means is, of course, we're losing a lot of species. This is why we have an extinction crisis, with 150 species being lost every day. But the species that we don't lose, they have to crowd into ever smaller fragments of habitat that we leave for them. And those fragments are more frequently next to where we live, our homes, our farms, our towns, etc. So if you, for example, cut down the forest where bats roosted far away from human habitations, they don't just disappear. They come and live in our back gardens and farms instead. And what we know is the entire outbreak of Ebola in West Africa in 2014 originated in a single spillover event, that is, a two-year-old child who was known to be playing near a tree where bats were roosting. And that child, you know, and it's very easy to imagine how it could have happened if a child plays with a piece of fruit that maybe has some bat saliva on it. It wouldn't necessarily even be visible. You could get it on your hands and put your hands in your mouth and that's it. The microbes that live in the animal's bodies has entered the human body. And that child fell ill. He infected his family members. They infected their healthcare workers and their family members and on we had this massive outbreak that killed over 11,000 people. So what we're seeing today is a process of environmental disruption sort of playing out that, you know, when I wrote my book in it came out in 2016, I talked to many emerging disease experts and there was a survey that was actually done. Over half said that a pandemic that would sicken 1 billion people, kill 165 million people, and cost the global economy $3 trillion would occur sometime in the next two generations. So this was something that the probabilities were there, and it was a sort of a ticking time bomb. Experts knew this was coming. So what's happening now, I think, is we have a moment, a political opportunity in this moment, because unlike, you know, before I wrote Pandemic, I wrote a book called The Fever, which was about malaria. And one of the big issues with malaria is that there's very little political will to get anything done about it. It's not a problem of technology. We've had cures for malaria for hundreds of years. We've known how to prevent it for over 100 years. And yet we still have hundreds of thousands of people who get sick and who die from malaria every year. And the reason that is because malaria is a disease of the poor. It's very much ghettoized in people who are poor. If you are poor, you're more likely to get malaria. And if you have malaria, you're more likely to become poor. So there's this dynamic between malaria and poverty. And that really dissipates political will to do anything about it. And that's one reason why the most cutting edge drug for malaria today is based on a 3,000-year-old Chinese remedy. We just don't do a lot of drug development for diseases that affect the poor. And what's interesting, I think, about this moment with this pandemic right now is that it, as much as the burdens are going to fall much heavier on the poor, migrants, you know, homeless people, all of the marginalized populations in the world and also societies, at the same time, it is affecting everyone since it's a respiratory pathogen and everyone's getting affected by this. Even the most wealthy elites in the world are getting sick. They're losing money. They're losing jobs. And so for, you know, in a very unique way, the entire population is really focused on this one pathogen. And so that, I think, provides a political opportunity because usually, you know, diseases that, you know, that have huge tolls like TB, HIV, malaria, diarrheal diseases. These are diseases that take hundreds of millions of people, you know, and has been doing that for years and years and years. And we have not solved those problems, even though we have very easy solutions for them, because there's no political will. And I think the coronavirus pandemic, because it is affecting so many people across the entire planet, including elites, including wealthy countries, that we have a political opportunity here to actually, you know, address some of the root causes. And I think a lot is going to depend on the stories we tell. You know, I think back to the outbreaks of cholera in the 19th century. And this is, you know, I wrote a lot about the cholera pandemics because cholera is one of our most successful pandemic-causing pathogens. It's caused not just one or two pandemics, but seven. So I wanted to see what that process was like. And I think back to how people thought about cholera back in the 19th century. In the city of London, for example, people thought that cholera was carried in what they called miasmas, that were what were kind of smelly airs, basically stink. And so they wanted to get rid of the smells to make themselves healthier, which is why they started installing flush toilets or water closets, as they called them back then, because they wanted to get rid of the smell. So they, you know, kept installing more water closets, get rid of the smell, but because they only cared about the smell, you know, and not the contents, they didn't mind that they were dumping all of their human waste into the River Thames. And so every time there was a cholera outbreak, they installed more water closets to dump more of their waste into their drinking water and therefore made it much worse. So the stories we tell about epidemics and where they come from are really going to shape our responses to them after they collapse. So what will the story be? I mean, all of these things are multifactorial, right? but for me, the environmental disruption is at the root of it. The expansion of industrial agriculture and, you know, industrial expansion generally is at the root of it. The destruction of habitat, wildlife habitat, is at the root of it. And then it's traveling through our global network that we've created so that we can trade all of these commodities very rapidly. And then it's amplifying in our cities, which are becoming urbanized and bigger with a real lack of infrastructure to support it. And so people are really vulnerable. And then on top of it, you know, the most unexpected part was the absolutely incompetent political response, even on behalf of governments that really had the wherewithal to do better. But we see already that there's going to be a contest about what is the story we tell about where this thing came from. Here in the United States, we see political leaders saying that this is the Chinese virus, right? This is something from outside of us. It's foreign. And that response means, what do you do? You close the borders. You prevent people from moving. You restrain people's mobility, you trap them, and you enclose yourself, isolate yourself. So, you know, and I think that, you know, we see that playing out in a lot of different ways. I mean, in some ways very overt, but I think in there's a subtle way in which the way we talk about the disease itself can contribute to that idea of sort of scapegoating and making this a foreign problem, which is, you know, to talk about viruses as invaders, you know, that this is an invasion that we need sort of a militaristic response. All of those metaphors of war and militarism, when we talk about disease, really lends itself to this idea that the germ, the disease, is something foreign and outside of us that we need to close ourselves from and isolate ourselves from. And I call it a kind of microbial xenophobia. And that's really been the paradigm in biomedicine for, you know, decades and decades now since, you know, the development of germ theory. So if we want to address sort of the environmental aspects of this pandemic, the social justice aspects, we need to be really clear about the story that we tell about why we have this problem right now. Secondly, I think in the medium term, a really important thing is going to be resisting an undifferentiated approach. That's what we're seeing right now, where, you know, China, the US, Europe are having this one kind of approach, and, you know, this is being implemented everywhere, even in places where, you know, staying at home doesn't make sense. It's not possible. You know, we need to insist on interventions that really respect people's human rights and are sensitive to their particular contexts. If we have just a one-size-fits-all approach, like, we're going to make this so much better, so much worse. The control efforts themselves will exact a huge cost, even outside of what the virus is going to do. So the final thing I want to add is, I think there's also, it's also important as progressives that we talk more about the role of science in all of this. You know, I think there is an impulse when we see political leaders making non-evidence-based decisions about policy to say, put the scientists up front, make the science be in charge. We want to hear from the science, then that should be the ultimate authority in all of this. And I think that is a little bit problematic. We have a whole history of, you know, when we have scientists in charge with the backing of the state without any oversight from civil society, is there's a very dark history of that violates human rights, whether it's the Tuskegee syphilis study here in the United States or forced sterilizations or unethical drug trials, et cetera. So at the same time that we want to elevate science, I think we want to bring science into the political sphere by, you know, empowering scientists in politics, but we also want to empower the public with scientific literacy. So we need to do both things, because we need to continue to have civil society oversight over, you know, what the scientists are saying and what our policies are going to be moving forward. We really want to have a democratization of science rather than just saying, let's make science more elite, more authoritative. And I think what's happening now is we're all getting a crash course in epidemiology. We're all getting a crash course in public health. And that's really good. And I think we need to keep doing that and lift each other up in those ways. And finally, I just, as a final thought, one of the things that gives me a lot of hope in these terribly dark and tragic times is that, unlike for most contagious diseases, when you have a new disease, there is no one-shot wonder drug. There is no magic pill. There's no commodity that we can buy and, you know, the wealthy can kind of, you know, ensconce themselves away from by having this one thing that they can buy and control. We all have to just work together. And it's really this moment where you have to have collective action and solidarity, because otherwise, you know, that's the only way, that's the only tool we have to arrest the spread of this virus at this time. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to your questions and to the other panelists.
Thank you so much, Sonia, for, I think, really rooting us in your research and your understandings from pandemics, which I think are really important guides. And that call for collective action and solidarity as a key response is a really good lead into the rest of our panel that I'm very pleased to present now. We're going to start this conversation, as I explained a little bit earlier, with a couple of short rounds with people from different parts of the globe and also different perspectives. And then we'll open up the conversation to everyone. So I would like to introduce first the other panelists together, and then I'll kind of pass to each in turn. So firstly, we have Dr. Luis Ortiz Hernandez. Luis is a public health professor at the Metropolitan Autonomous University in Mexico City. Luis was part of a former TNI co-run project called the Municipal Services Project that ran for a number of years, that researched best practices in delivering equitable and sustainable public water, health and electricity services. Luis will be joining us from Mexico City. After Luis, we'll hear from Benny Curavilla. Benny is the head of the India Office of Focus on the Global South. As Fiona explained briefly earlier, Focus is an Asia-based regional think tank that conducts research and policy analysis on trade and development, democracy and people's alternatives. Benny is actively involved with the Forum for Trade Justice in India, which is a network of trade unions, peasant organizations, social movements, academics and civil society organizations. Benny is joining us from New Delhi today. We also have with us Mazibuko Hara. Mazibuko was the founding chairperson of the Treatment Action Campaign in 1998, which led a global campaign for access to antiretroviral drugs in the face of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. He's currently deputy director at the Chisimani Center for Activist Education and one of the key people involved in the new COVID-19 People's Coalition in South Africa. He's joining us from the Eastern Cape in South Africa. And last but definitely not least, we have Umaira Ahmed from the Association of Women's Rights and Development, AWID. Umaira is a feminist with a background in international human rights law, and her work at AWID focuses on challenging and disrupting fundamentalist and fascist narratives and organizing. She has also worked with national and grassroots women's rights organizations in South and Southeast Asia to improve women's access to justice in cases of domestic and family violence. She is joining us from Malaysia. So my first question to all of you, and we'll start in the order that I've shared, is just any brief reflections on what Sonia has just shared from your own experience, And what do you consider the most pressing issue right now in terms of the pandemic as it falls from your vantage point? Over to you, Luis. Welcome to this call.
Hi, everyone. I think that this is a very hard question because I think that we do not need to only think in this very moment, but what is the future for everyone? I mean, I think that this is an opportunity to think how each society is coping with this epidemic and what is the better way of face. And I think I invite the audience to follow the news in two countries. On one hand, you can see that Cuba is sending medical missions around the world or in many countries because they have controlled the epidemic. In the opposite side, we have USA that unfortunately they are unable to stop the infection. And I think that this dissimilar situation is very related with how their health systems are organized. And I think this is very interesting to underline that Cuba is a low-income country. They have very low resources, but they have a unified, universal health system organized around the family physicians. And the way that they facing the epidemic is sending community workers to identify the people who get the infection and then isolate it. This is a very low cost and effective way, but it depends on a public health system. In the contrast, the US model of health system is based on in public and private insurance. And these have a lot of implication. For example, right now in US, hospitals and government at different levels are compete for the ventilators because in fact, they don't have a really health system. They have a lot of health insurance companies and a lot of not-profit and private hospitals and clinics, and they are not organized. In addition, it is pretty sad that you can see in the news that one of the discussion is around how the insurance will charge to government or take care of the sick people. So I think that we are in a moment that we have to think what kind of health system we have to have in each country and around the globe. So I think that this is not a question that we have to solve in this moment, but I think that this is a learning that we have to think for the future. I think that I want to stop here and after I develop another ideas.
Great, thank you, Luis. Benny, what's your reflections on both what Sonia shared and what do you consider the most pressing issue right now in India and from your perspective in Asia?
Thanks, Nick. Let me just start with giving you a sense of what is happening in India. We are today at day 8 of a 21-day total lockdown of the Indian economy. And so far, we've had around 1,700 cases and around 40 COVID-19 related deaths. But many public health experts believe that these numbers are deflated, especially because there's been some level of community spread, and that India still is not doing enough tests and monitoring. But, you know, we announced, the Indian Prime Minister announced a lockdown on the 24th of March with just a 4-hour notice. And what we've seen after that is a much, much bigger crisis unraveling in the country. And that's where I want to pick on from Sonia's point about that we need to have a more humane and solidarity-based approach to managing the crisis. Now, what has happened in the last 2 weeks is, you know, devastating sort of consequences for the poor and working classes. Now, India has around 400 plus million people in the workforce, and out of which around 94 are in the informal sector. And many of these people have left rural India, you know, due to a long-standing agrarian crisis. And they're now in cities doing precarious jobs in construction, restaurants, retail, small factories, often earning daily wages with no social security, and live in sort of cramped rental accommodations. And with the shutdown announced on the 24th, you've had millions of these migrant workers, you know, and estimates are at 100 million, you know, beginning a mass exodus from business centers into rural areas. And people have said this is by far the largest migration in Indian history. Just in the national capital region of Delhi, where I am based, the number of workers who've been impacted due to the lockdown and who need access to food is a staggering 6 million people, according to trade union representatives who've now been on the front lines sort of providing food, because the state has been completely unable to deal with something that they announced a week ago. And also linked to the impending economic collapse and the recession, the ILO a couple of days ago put out a figure of 25 million global, you know, job losses. And I'm afraid it's completely off the mark for India. In India, the figures are at 136 million. And just in travel and tourism, the numbers are at 20 million. So, you know, for us sitting in India, we're really dealing with a double whammy. One is, of course, we need to, you know, be sort of responding to the important task of containing the spread of the coronavirus. But, you know, we have to urgently deal with the social and economic consequences on the vulnerable. And in fact, the death toll of, you know, from people migrating back, road accidents, walking hundreds of kilometers without food and due to heart attacks, that number is at 22. So I think to reiterate Sonia's point, I think we need to work together both, and several movements that are putting pressures on state governments. We also need, and I can add some aspects of that in the next session. But yeah, I think we need to look at, you know, not just managing the sort of crisis, but the impending economic sort of collapse in a more humane way, which, you know, with solidarity, looking at the impacts on the sort of vulnerable and the marginalized.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Benny, for sharing that with us. I'd like to now pass over to Mazibuko in South Africa. Great to have you with us, Mazibuko. What's your sense of what's happening right now in South Africa? What's the most pressing issue from your perspective?
Thank you, Nick. We have millions of poor and working people across South Africa who are under a militarized lockdown, locked away in shanty towns, in townships, in inner cities, in rural villages, with no food, no income, no running water, no local health facilities. On top of that, they are also facing a failing public health system, where the majority of health resources through private insurance, private hospitals, are in private hands. at the time of a serious pandemic, a government that has opted not to appropriate those privatized health resources. Also a government that has put forward a very inadequate social and economic measures to respond to the pandemic. Pandemic. What's even worse is the fact that this very government has actually opened up opportunities for further maximization of profit by interventions that allow the private sector to dominate the narrative, to dominate the response. South Africa is the most industrialized country in Africa. You can imagine then the more challenging circumstances elsewhere. If in South Africa you have a government that's failing to do this. Elsewhere in the continent, there's even weaker public health systems, which then emphasizes the need for people-based approaches. How do we use at this moment the power of ordinary people to challenge our elites in the African continent, who are completely out of their depth, completely at sea as to what to do to actually use the crisis to take us back to national projects of building health as a public good, of building economies in ways that work for the people. That's it. That's a general context facing us in South Africa, but I think it has echoes elsewhere in the continent.
Thank you, Maziboko. I know, Amira, when we talked yesterday, you're also facing quite a kind of militarized situation as well in Malaysia. Perhaps you can share some of your perspectives from your vantage point.
Thanks so much, and thanks everyone for that really constructive input. I think one thing that I'd like to reiterate and also take from what the others have discussed is that what we're currently seeing in this moment and what has been highlighted by everyone is specifically the disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the most vulnerable communities. And one thing that we can also say is that this impact cannot be seen in isolation from the underlying systemic failures of the interplay between power structures that have historically oppressed and undermined the rights of marginalized people. And so I think one thing that I would feel and what we see from the trends of the different responses from governments and also citizens all over the world is that the manifestations of this pandemic has also need to be understood through the impact of growing authoritarianism around the world, growing fundamentalisms, and also how these interplay with neoliberal systems and how they mutually reinforce themselves at this moment in a lot of our different contexts and how it impacts the most marginalized specifically, and including women, girls, and also people of diverse sexualities from the global south. So I think what I'll do is just highlight a bit of what we've seen specifically of how anti-rights actors, specifically state actors, religious fundamentalist groups, and also kind of fascist groups have taken advantage of the uncertainty of this pandemic to further push back on rights and to consolidate and expand their political and social power, specifically through, we can see this through kind of certain common trends. I think one of the common ideological threads that we see is the underlying racism and xenophobia that's heightened. And also, as Sonia had mentioned, the attacks to specific communities that are seen to be culpable and also responsible for this pandemic, and these forces are using this as a justification for racial profiling, for closing of borders. We can see this in Southeast Asia, in Cambodia and India, where we see Muslim communities are being blamed for the spread of the virus, and also commonly in the West, where we see xenophobic attacks on the Chinese community. I think another thing that's really important to mention is how emergency measures and carceral responses has been pushed as a new normal right now, where mass surveillance and also the misuse of personal data is being justified. We also see the tendencies to push for exceptional laws, which mostly from our historical learning has usually stayed on after the crisis and impacts the most vulnerable communities. So in India, we see, for example, and Benny would, of course, be able to speak more to this, is we see the government invoking an Epidemic Disease Act, which is a colonial area law that grants law enforcement agencies with greater executive powers. And another trend that I think is really important to highlight as well is looking at how misinformation and propaganda is attacked, whether through state control, media, or privately owned, and we're even seeing this proliferation in online spaces through bots are spreading misinformation, and at the same time, governments are also using, for example, misinformation kind of legislations to also push back on freedom of speech. So there's kind of a something that we need to consider in terms of these two issues. And on a broader scale, what we're also seeing in this region is the blaming and stigmatizing of the pandemics on certain communities, specifically the LGBT community and progressive movements. So for example, in Malaysia, what we see is that Islamic bodies and Islamic kind of religious leaders are blaming the LGBT community for the pandemic and saying specifically that putting forward this narrative to further discriminate against these communities. And what we're also seeing come forward quite interestingly from a feminist perspective is that there are some common themes of messaging that's being put out as well. There's a what we see in the media as well is a return to or also heightened narrative of a pro-traditional family and how state measures are also thinking about their responses are still within this very heteronormative kind of patriarchal structure of a family, for example. So I think one thing that I would also say that's important as we move forward is also to think about how these authoritarian responses and tendencies are rising as we see the leaders aim to employ chaos and apocalyptic thinking that accompanies deep insecurity to consolidate their power and undermine existing forms of democracy. At the same time, we're also seeing a lot of communities and a lot of narratives that are being put out that are centering the voices of marginalized groups. They are also bringing the narratives and realities of an alternative system to challenge these things. So I think moving forward, that's one thing that we need to think about in terms of internationalist solidarity response. But I'll cover that more in the next slide.
Thank you very much, Amira. I would like to bring back Luis into the conversation. And Luis, when we were talking about this the other day, we were also talking about how this kind of asked the question, you know, what is good health? What determines good health? And I know that's very much part of your work, looking at health in a kind of broad context. So what do you think this pandemic is revealing, not just about the public health systems, which you've shared about, but more broadly about what needs to change to make people more resilient to pandemics and more able to respond to them and in general to have better health to cope with the many other diseases that kill many people that don't get the same attention as this current moment?
My training as in social medicine make me think about the health problems are determined by the circumstances that we born, grow, work, live, and get older. And based on this idea, I think that we have to think how different age groups or different social groups are affected in different way. In this case, one of the groups that are more affected are the seniors. We know that most of the deaths are concentrated in older people. And in the case of Latin America, we have a lot of issues with older people. For example, the coverage of formal pensions is pretty low. In the Central America, where Mexico is included, only 20% of seniors have a pension, excuse me. And whereas countries such as Bolivia and Ecuador, they have a coverage of 20%. And only countries like Uruguay or Costa Rica have a coverage higher than 50%. And this is a very important question, because if you don't have a stable income, you don't have access to healthcare, and you can take part of this isolation measures or keeping your house. In addition, in Latin America, most seniors, because don't have a pension, they have to work, or they depend on government aid. For example, in Central America, more than 50% of seniors don't have a pension, and in Andean countries, Bolivia, Ecuador, the percentage is higher than 60%. So you can imagine how an old people can cope with much difficulties these epidemics. So as societies, we have to think how to we can support the seniors. Not only think about our families, how families can take care of them, but how the states or as societies we have to provide a base income for all citizens. And I think, as Benny said already, that other segment of the population that is very vulnerable in this situation is workers in the informal sector, than in Latin America and other South low countries. This is very high proportion of the population. So I think that we have to think that how we our living condition prepare us or not to face this kind of crisis, or the level of health that we have.
Thank you, Luis. I want to go back to Benny. I know you've been very much involved also in working on trade policy in the Forum for Trade Justice. And so I'd be interested to hear a bit more about how you think also that some things like trade policy intersect here with health, and what would be needed. What would be a people's trade and health agenda as we move forward too, because this will very much shape the international response to this pandemic.
Thanks, Nick. You know, one of the enduring lessons of dealing with the crisis for the last, you know, month or so in India has been, you know, the recognition among policymakers, and, you know, movements have also pushed this, the People's Health Movement, for instance, trade unions, etc., that we urgently need to ramp up, you know, policies to ensure public health and food sovereignty. And on both of these counts, you know, the prevailing trade regime is going to create barriers. And if you look at some of the data that's coming out, it's evident that global trade is going to take a battering. You have, you know, granular data coming about the complete collapse of trade in goods, and the predictions are for a much sharper fall in global trade than the 2008 financial crisis. The figures are around 20% drop in global trade in 2020. also because this is riding on an existing downturn in global trade. But you know, one lesson that all of us need to learn from the 2008 financial crisis is that trade bounces back sooner or later. It might be a year, it might be 2 years, and then, you know, it's business as usual. And in health, and actually this applies for the manufacturing sector as well in India. And, you know, one aspect that has come out is India's excessive import sort of dependence. So if you take, for example, bulk drugs, what are called active pharmaceutical ingredients, which are needed as a raw material to make medicines. And India has quite a vibrant generic medicines industry. Now, 70% of India's APIs or bulk drugs are imported from China. If you look at a basic medicine like paracetamol, 100% of that API comes from China. And there's no reason why such a large, you know, developing country like India should be importing these, and why can't we produce our own APIs? And the question of ventilators, you raised it in your sort of opening remarks. For a population of 1.3 billion people, India has around 40 to 50,000 ventilators. The US, with 1/4 of India's population, has 160,000 ventilators, and that's already been seen as woefully inadequate. I mean, there was a report about workers at a GE aviation facility demanding that factories be recalibrated to be able to manufacture ventilators. So one of the lessons I think that we should learn and push for is for a more activist industrial policy where we localize production where we can, but we also ensure regional diversity. And there's no reason why we can't have, you know, South-South cooperation in, say, the Southeast and South Asian regions. You know, and for many years, free trade dogma has allowed what are called global value chains to run, right, where production is, you know, outsourced to, you know, the cheapest and most competitive locations with minimal labor and environmental standards. So we need to ensure that, you know, there's a trade framework that allows for critical medical equipment, medicines, to not only be made in the country, but also be, like I said, diversify supply chains to the south. So other countries can develop their own sort of industrial capacity through, you know, frameworks such as transfer of technology, local performance requirements. And all of these have been vilified and prohibited by agreements like the WTO's TRIMs, the trade-related investment measures. You have clauses in bilateral investment treaties that prohibit this. And of course, free trade rules need to be challenged and changed at the level of patents as well. And this is a battle that is being fought from the Uruguay round itself. You know, just 2 days ago, many of us signed on to an open letter to the US pharma giant Gilead, demanding that it relinquish from patenting the drug Remdesivir, which is apparently the furthest along in terms of any of the therapeutic drugs that can possibly treat COVID-19. And by the way, this drug was developed with considerable public funding, both in terms of early stage research and clinical trials. And some of you might know that Costa Rica has already submitted a proposal calling for access to technologies to combat COVID-19. You have, you know, the People's Health Movement and other health networks, you know, going to be, you know, working on this, and we need to be in solidarity with these groups. And another lesson that we need to internationalize from the COVID-19 experience is the failure of the privatization of health. And Louise also alluded to that. And there are examples from across Asia where governments are now recognizing the limits of private hospitals and dealing with, you know, the emergency, and private hospitals are being requisitioned for the public good. The state of Kerala, there have been a few cases where private hospitals have been taken over. Now, this also, again, will come into conflict with clauses in, you know, investment treaties that prohibit expropriation. But when you have so many cases of privatization of essential services like health not working, the state should be allowed to nationalize these sectors without fear of international arbitration. And in fact, you know, TNI, along with other organizations, the Municipal Services Project, which Louise has been part of, has already documented in the last decade and a half close to 1,000 cases of you know, deprivatization or remunicipalization and the creation of new sort of public entities in more than 50 countries, you know. And we need to ensure that these are the examples that we take forward, but we also reimagine, you know, the public sector in India. One of the challenges has been that the public sector has been bureaucratized, it's not been democratized, it's not seen, you know, as a people's sector. We need to work, and the MSP project has done, you know, excellent work on these issues. And I also want to bring in the point of agriculture. And, you know, with the entire country under lockdown and supply chains disrupted, both the federal government and regional governments have been scrambling to get food grains to workers who are out of work and therefore have no money to buy food. And like I told you, you know, 94% of our workforce is in the informal sector. And if, you know, their firms shut down, they have no avenue to get food, etc. And one of the reasons why India's partially managed to deal with this crisis is because of the Indian system of public procurement, stock holding, and the distribution of food. And for many years in the WTO, the US has been sort of attacking India's public stock holding policies, arguing that it is an unfair subsidy, it's wasteful, and it should be shut down in favor of cash transfers. You have a lot of, you know, neoliberal institutions like the World Bank and others pushing for cash transfers. And this emergency has critically underlined the importance of such subsidies, such as the public sort of distribution system, procurement. And, you know, these policies should not undermine the sovereign, you know, right of governments. And I'm talking about these WTO cases in terms of ensuring that, you, and these are policies that protect peasants as well as, you know, consumers to access food. And these are policies not just being used in India. You have Indonesia with its sort of Bulog program. Philippines has similar sort of public stockholding and sort of distribution programs. Pakistan, Kenya, Tanzania. And I can guarantee you, when we have this crisis getting deeper with, you know, massive job losses, these are the programs that are going to ensure that the state has a more humane response. And we have groups on the ground trying to ramp this up. And if I have time, I don't know if there's, I mean, I just want to make a quick point.
Perhaps, Benny, we could just come back and bring this in, kind of, yeah, maybe make the final point when we have the round of questions and bring it into there, because I want to make sure everyone has a chance to speak. Mazibuko, I was wondering if you could perhaps reflect a little bit more, and particularly from your experience at the Treatment Action Campaign and now the People's Coalition. What are some of the priorities you think we should have as international movements right now? What should be our agenda, and what are the big priorities of this moment as we think about how we can organize transnationally in response to this crisis? What experiences would you draw on, and what priorities would you point out?
Thank you, Nick. The pandemic is giving us a wonderful opportunity to rebuild the organized power of ordinary people, particularly around saving lives, preventing infections, on the basis of public information, on the basis of challenging failing services, the failing state, but also in situations of lockdown, challenging the violations of rights, which inevitably leads to some form of resistance. So the challenge for us is to use all of those circumstances to build organizational resistance, to build alternative creative mutual aid. That's already happening in many parts across the world, but how do we give it a political dynamic? How do we give it legs and feet that builds anew? That's the challenge facing us. But also linked to that is the question of learning from the traditions of primary healthcare, community-based health, experiences and models, which can actually serve as a form of socializing health way beyond state controlled systems. Because as much as we're demanding public health, but actually public health under a state that's living under a yoke of neoliberalism can still have its own problems. So actually there is a crucial question for us to answer. Whether there is some form of popular welfare, popular economy logic that can emerge in this time of the pandemic. What I would like to add to that is the notion of health as a right, the notion of health as a public good. And in this regard, I think Benny has spoken quite well about the unjust and inequitable trade system, whereby as countries of the South, we can form united fronts around parallel importing, compulsory licensing, local production, challenging this inequitable trade system. This is an area where we can rebuild the activism we saw during the at the height of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, when many countries of the South could not access life-saving medicines. And this is crucial because it can be linked, as Benny also was saying, to rebuilding manufacturing capacity, not just of medicines, but also of a whole range of needed equipment and other aspects of the intervention, which are completely absent in the countries of the South. This takes me to the last point I want to make, the question of finance, the question of economic policies. Many countries in the South are going to need finance, which they do not have in their fiscals, to respond to this. Unfortunately, there is not much of a thriving alternative financing system outside of the IMF and the World Bank. So they're going to be forced in a way to go back to countries which are actually attending to their own populations. They're going to be forced to go with a begging bowl to the IMF and the World Bank. This remains a huge barrier. At the same time as this is a barrier, some countries like Brazil, South Africa, to an extent India, have significant public resources, whether it's the public pension system, or unemployment insurance systems, or other ways in which money has been collected from those who are in employment. How can we put pressure on our governments in those major countries of the South so that those funds actually become public and serve the public purpose in the time of the pandemic? That's one possible way out, but that's for a limited set of countries. There's a bigger question for countries without even such a pool of saviors.
Thank you, Mazibuko. Mara, finally to you. I think what's coming through partly is that there's both immense challenges, but also some, as Mazibuko said, a sense of opportunities as well of this moment. If we can mobilize and push for the longer term, both the short term response and the longer term changes we need. What do you see as the challenges and opportunities of this moment?
I think also to kind of reiterate what has been said, I think this poses also a really crucial moment for us as social movements, as people to kind of rethink and organize around reimagining and envisioning and realizing what a transformative system of economic, political, and governance would look like. They are based on human rights principles, they are based on principles of accountability, justice, and collective care. And I think it's also a very opportune moment to kind of think about what is the alternative that we want, and within this system where clearly global governance and multilateralism is clearly not able to respond to these pandemics, is also how do we want to, as a movement, restructure and connect our struggles and also demands together. And I think this is a big opportunity for us to look at. And I think in terms of framing our demands, I think there's also an opportunity to highlight and also amplify new narratives of realities, as I mentioned earlier, that we are seeing of communities that are actually working on the ground. I think spreading these new possibilities and co-creating a world that can resist and challenge the mainstream economic and political systems that are also generative and transformational is a key kind of opportunity that I'm seeing. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you very much all for some really rich inputs. We've now got a chance now to open up the conversation, and I know that there's been a huge amount of really helpful both comments, suggestions, questions that have come in on both the Q&A part of this call and also in the chat space. I haven't been able to follow them all closely, but a few, I'm going to pull out a few themes that have come through, and I'm going to ask all the questions, and I'll pose this to a few of you, but you pick up on the question that most you feel most happy to address. So these are some of the questions that have come through. Is one is, what does resistance and organizing, especially internationally at this particular moment, look like? There was another webinar done by Mike Davis where he said that the left can't yield the streets, and that's where movements have power. But how realistic is this at this moment? And if we move online, how do we deal with the fact that penetrative technology is very uneven globally? So any reflections on how do we organize internationally in this moment would be really helpful. The second question is that there was some talk, and speakers have talked about the importance of narratives in shaping our response. And so people would like a bit more elaboration on this. How important is the question about where it originated? How can we reshape the military metaphors that are driving and shaping the current response? What better metaphors are available? The third sort of group of questions come around the kind of institutions and actors. So what are the possible roles? What are the roles for informal organizations and social movements? What can we as political actors do to shape an internationalist response which respects human rights? I guess the last set of questions is around how do we prevent backsliding? Lots of people say there's been lots of back to normal, but normal was already a crisis. It's a climate crisis. It's a social crisis. There's deep inequality. So how do we ensure that we don't return to normal or even to a new normal, which is more authoritarian and doesn't address some of the longer crisis we face? So I'm going to So pick up on any of these questions, panelists. I don't expect you to address them all, but ones that particularly interest you. And also use this as a moment to make any kind of final reflections. And I'd like to start with Sonia.
Yeah, I think the question of narratives, I don't think we know what that narrative is going to look like yet, but I think what's clear is that we need sort of a dynamic rhetoric that, that really captures this overall picture. So, for me, what I see is this paradigm of growth, economic growth sort of prioritized over human rights, sustainability, all that other stuff, that paradigm is really, and the idea of externalizing the costs of that, externalizing the environmental costs, the human rights costs, all of that. And what we're seeing now is that the bill is coming due. And I think those are the connections we have to make, that we have the standing disaster of poverty and inequality, but now we also have climate disasters as a result. We also now have biological disasters, which is what this pandemic is. So bringing that all together is, I think, going to be key to kind of reimagining and reconfiguring like the rhetoric around where these diseases come from and where this pandemic is coming from. I guess the other thing I would add is that this, just to underline this idea of going back to business as usual. I mean, one of the most frustrating things about writing about the history of contagions and infectious diseases is how resilient people are to going right back to what they were doing before as soon as the epidemic collapses. And I really think that especially in parts of the world where we're going to be able to have a commodity that will solve this, a vaccine or a drug treatment or something like that, that interest in looking at the underlying drivers is going to dissipate really quickly. So I think we have, there's a moment here to kind of reframe the narrative. And I don't know that it's clear exactly how to do that, but I think it's something we need to kind of bring all of our imaginations together to really work at.
Thank you, Sonia. Mazibuko, do you have any reflections on any of those particular questions or any kind of concluding remarks you'd like to make, having listened to the conversation so far?
The pandemic is giving us an opportunity to underline that the responses must not be militaristic, must actually underline the need for public health interventions. That's very crucial that we focus on public health. For example, the armies that are being rolled out to patrol the streets could be used differently to roll out public field hospitals in public vacant land and so on. So that notion of public health as a key intervention is going to be key. But also, as people are seeing the inadequacies of the state, particularly in our countries of the South, I think it's time to bring back in quite a smart way critiques of the neoliberal state and put forward questions to ordinary people about how do we see organizing beyond the limits of the neoliberal state. That's not going to be easy, but it's required. This is the moment for progressive forces across the world to really strike at that.
Omaira, I was wondering if you might have any reflections on that question about organizing transnationally in this moment. How do we do it given that movements have generally done that through streets, street protests, and also we have this big issue of the kind of digital inequality if we move online. So, and also just beyond that, if you have any other kind of responses to some of the questions that I posed from the group, from the whole webinar.
Thanks so much. I think I'd like to return to this concept of connecting struggles specifically, and how as social movements in responding to inequalities, there's a tendency for us to work in silos, and oftentimes seeing our work as, while we are recognizing that these kind of inequalities impact identities differently. But I think right now, at this particular moment where there is a heightened focus of the international arena and also the media in recognizing these failures, there's an opportunity for different movements to come together and really hash out and think about a strategy to connect through narrative building, for example, and also to think about within this international multilateral system that we're working in, giving its failures, what is it exactly that we want? And I know some have, I think it was Benny who highlighted the response of the IMF. They're still responding based on a very neoliberal kind of approach. And if we also want to challenge that, how do we kind of, we have to start thinking about how we would want to come together and to say that in terms of narrative, there is another possibility. And while we don't have that answer, I think putting out there forward and starting to envision and think about what we can do to actually propose or imagine an alternative narrative, I think is really important. Thank you.
And Luis, there was a question around kind of roles of institutions and actors in this moment. I was wondering, particularly in terms of health, there's a whole array of international institutions that engage in health. How can social movements engage with either the IMF or around health, and or also the WHO, the UN, and so on? What can global movements do to tackle some of the global bodies, and where do you see the openings and challenges there?
I feel sorry because I don't have a specific answer to that question, but in this moment, I want to share with you, all of you, general thoughts. One is that I think that this is a very moment with a lot of uncertainty and scare. And I think that this is very important to recognize these thoughts and feelings, because this is a very novel situation for everyone around the globe. At least for me, this is it's a very overwhelming experience. This made me feel that it's hard to think alternatives or make a very deep analysis. In addition, I think that we have to recognize that as any novel situation, we don't know how the things will evolve. For example, 1 month ago, the situation that USA is experienced, I think that was unthinkable. And we don't know how the epidemic will evolve. And we don't know what is the best alternative or option right now. So I think that we have to be patient and tolerant to the uncertainty and wait to after the epidemic ends. I hope the epidemic ends. I think that we have the best scenario to think more options and think what is the best option. And the other thought that I want to share, and this is about the narratives. I think that right now, the predominant narrative in some spaces is focused on the individuals. At the end, just thinking in the ventilators is just thinking the solution for one person. And for moments, the countries are only thinking in its population, in their populations, and are not thinking in, we think us as one humanity. The close of borders is not just a solution to limit the epidemic. It's just, it's too a way of thinking that this is a problem on one nation, and it's not thinking as we are one humanity, and the problem of one country is a problem of other ones. And in this respect, I think that, for example, the role of World Health Organization as another is not just give data or guidelines, but I think that they have to have a more as coordinate the response. I think that I just think general thoughts. I think that there's a very it's very hard to think of very specific ideas in this moment, for at least for me.
I understand. I totally. Benny, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think in terms of driving the narrative, social movements across the world, progressive researchers have been, you know, quick to respond. And you know, there's a lot of analysis out there. There is some pressure being put. I mean, it could be statements, it could be, you know, articles and, you know, newspapers, etc. But I also want to say that, you know, institutions are responding. So the WTO, the WHO, and the FAO put out a statement yesterday saying that, you know, trade and food should continue and we should not stop what's been, you know, in, you know, the sort of neoliberal way of doing things. And yeah, I think that's going to be a challenge in terms of how do you sort of confront this, because, you know, we need to recognize that social movements, you know, the left is on the back foot. I mean, we have right-wing governments across the South and the North. But I think the ray of hope, at least in India, is in the way that regional governments have responded. And linked to the point that I made about, you know, inspiring examples of remunicipalization, they're all happening at the local, you know, at the city level, at the state government. So we need to work, I think, at multiple levels, you know, build these solidarities and alternatives at the local level, but also engage. And I agree with Luis that there's no real, you know, there's no clarity on how we go about it. But I just want to end also that, you know, one of the big winners of this is big tech. And I think we need to be looking closely at how big tech is going to, and you know, there's the articles that are saying that, you know, the tech backlash is sort of temporarily being, you know, set aside. But in the way Amazon has just hired 100,000 workers in India as well, you see far more people now getting into online delivery. We are speaking to each other, you know, through Zoom. So I think that's one area that also that we need to sort of be attentive to.
Thank you. And I think I cut off Mazibuko. You wanted to make a final point. So I just wanted to bring you back in, Mazibuko. We have just a few minutes there, so it'll have to be brief.
Now, a very quick point about food. We have no time to talk about food because food is going to be crucial in building immunity, but also it's very crucial to the survival of ourselves. This moment is a moment for us to also raise some tough questions and even go as far as possible to go back to radical land redistribution, but also transformation of the food system from production all the way through the value chain. That's crucial. And we are fortunate in some countries where we have strong peasant movements mobilizing in this regard. And in South Africa, there has been a revival of interest on the food question, even amongst the urban population who primarily depend on cash, which now is run out for them to access food. So this food question of the food system is going to be crucial as part of an integrated system response. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't unmute. Mazibuko. So we're coming to the end of the call, and I'm conscious that, of course, this call will only scratch the surface. I think we kind of, this raised so many different dimensions of the crisis. There's the immediate crisis, there's the underlying crisis, and there's also the economic fallout that we're going to have as a result. And so in a sense, that's why that I could totally identify with Luis's comments about being a bit overwhelmed. I think that's been the experience of all of us, and knowing how to strategically to kind of address it. But I'm really glad we've had this conversation. I've deeply appreciated all the inputs we had from Sonia and all the other panelists. So thank you very much for all your sharing. We are conscious at TNI that this is the beginning of a conversation, that this conversation will take place in lots of different arenas. And I just wanted to share some immediate ways that the Transnational Institute plans to follow up. Firstly, I want to say that we are kind of closely following the questions and the feedback that you've put on the chat. And we're gonna close this in 2 minutes as a panel, but we're gonna keep the chat open. So if you do have suggestions about and comments, but about both the content but also the kind of strategies, do leave some comments there in the chat. You're also welcome, if you need some more time, to email Jess Graham, from whom you'll have got the confirmation email, and we'll be sharing that and discussing that with our co-organizing partners AIDC and the Focus on the Global South. I also want to share that we're gonna continue throughout April a weekly webinar series that will delve deeper into some of these issues. And I can tell you that next week at the same time, it may be a shorter call, we may try and stick it to an hour, we will have a focus on particularly the economic consequences. And we already have confirmed for that the well-known economist from India, Jayati Ghosh, and we hope to have some other key people on that call. We'll certainly, and we've just put up a poll, which you should see on your screen, for you to say which particular issues you think are really important to delve deeper into. What are the priorities you have? So please do fill that in. That will give us a sense of where to focus our energy. I'd like to also encourage everyone to sign up to the newsletters of the three organizations involved in this, the AIDC, Focus, and TNI. That way you can kind of follow up what each of us are doing around this. I know AIDC is planning a webinar looking at this, particularly the Latin America and the impact in Latin America and Africa and the African continent. So look out for the web addresses in the chat. And of course, if you are in a position to donate, we always welcome any of the organizations involved in this webinar. Welcome hugely any donations that can make. That will help us to organize more sessions like this and develop the work that we will need to all be working on to confront this pandemic. So I just want to finish this call by thanking everyone, our co-sponsors, and especially to all of you who joined in. It was really amazing to get more than, well, at some point we had more than 650 people on this webinar. That, as I said at the beginning, is a really inspiring sign that, and we're seeing that everywhere, that people are getting together and finding their own solutions, amazing mutual aid initiatives, amazing community-based responses. And here we have on this call lots of people with lots of ideas about how to confront this and to confront future challenges and future crises. So thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. See, I hope, many of you next week. And meanwhile, the chat will stay open. So